Are you on dope?
Yes.
What kind?
Musical dope.
You get high?
Yes.
Off of what?
Music.
Are you on a trip or something?
Yes.
What kind of a trip?
Music.
How old are you?
I'm old in mind, but young in age.
This is Brianna Marie, and you're listening to Soul Discovery, a place run by passion and really dedicated to its music, artists, producers, and record labels, which makes it a unique place, but also a place where listeners come to really absorb themselves and can tap into their emotions and take themselves on a discovery of their own.
Near and far, family, there can Welcome along, Soul Discovery. Have I got a special show for you today? The one and only, the fantastic, incredible, Grammy-nominated, Emmy-nominated, award-winning producer, songwriter, director, CEO of Singer Studios, film producer, podcast producer, and documentaries, Eloise Laws. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Nick. I think you left something out. I'm a member of the famous Lost family.
Well, we were going to get round to that later on in the show, but welcome along.
Well, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
It's great to catch up with you after all these years. I don't mean that as an insult, but you've got some pedigree. You've got some wonderful music. I don't know how we're going to squeeze it all in, but we'll try. We'll go back and have a look about your history of how you started, etc. So for our listeners, let us know where you were born and what that was like growing up.
Well, I don't want to say when I was born because that was many, many decades ago. I'd like to get past that and just say, at this point in my life, I am seasoned and I have wisdom and I don't make the same mistakes I did many, many years ago. But I was born in Houston, Texas during the war. I'm going to put it that way. Most people can find out the truth on Wikipedia. I, for many, many years, didn't really tell my age until I reached 80, and I thought that was such a blessing. So I said, listen, I should not be hiding that. Most people don't make it to be to their 80s. And so I'm very fortunate. Yes, I'm now 80 and some years. Born in Houston, Texas, and raised there, and went to school there, high school, and went to 4 years of college there at Texas Southern University, which is really when my career took off, and I've never looked back.
What was it like with your parents? Did they influence you? Were they taking you to gospel churches? Were they listening to music through them?
Absolutely. Both parents were musically talented. My mom was played the piano, and she played for the choir that I, as a young girl, started singing in at 12 years old. My sister, Blanche, who never became a professional singer, but we were all in the choir together. And it was a lot of music being played at my house on a daily basis, because sometimes we'd have choir rehearsals there as well. So I was always around music. And if we weren't practicing and singing, we had the phonograph record going. And my mom was playing singers like Aretha Franklin and Bobby Blue Bland and Dinah Washington and Dakota Staton and Billie Holiday, and the beat goes on.
Yeah. And that worked, did it, being gospel and heavily into the church as well, because they kind of frowned of that in the old days, didn't they, about listening.
Absolutely. And I did forget to mention the Clara Ward singers. At that time, I was very young, but they were like the pinnacle or staple in Texas as gospel singers. I mean, we really grew up listening to the Five Blind Boys and again, the Clara Ward singers and Mahavia Jackson. These were some of the big influences in my life at an early age.
Yeah, and your first gig, as we'll say, is in 1965 when you won an award with CBS at the Fellowship, involved with Clive Davis. Can you, and the Harry
yes.
Belafonte?
Yes, that was the turning point in my life, really. I actually sang at my commencement exercise when I was graduating from high school. The head of the music department just happened to be at the commencement exercise. I had no plans or had not saved, and we were too poor for me to go to college. So I was going to take a nursing course and become a nurse. That was the only plans I had after finishing high school. But the head of the music department at Texas Southern University was at the commencement, and I call that divine intervention, because when he heard me do the solo for How Great Thou Art, they offered me a scholarship, a music scholarship, to come to Texas Southern University. And that really was the beginning. I had no idea what was in store for me once I started the university there. It was a full scholarship. And from there, I happened to be passing by in the auditorium at the music department. And there was a talent scout from CBS, much like the scouts that they do on The Voice or American Idol, very, very similar to that. And they were auditioning students, and I knew nothing about it. I happened to be walking past where the auditions were held, and somebody said, "Aren't you going to sing? These people are from New York. Aren't you going to sing?" And I'm like, "I don't know. What am I going to, you know?" I was young and afraid. And eventually I went, took a seat, and they said, "Okay, we had to sign a sheet. The next person. So I got up and I sang Billie Holiday, which I knew by memory from my mom playing it all the time. I sang "Them That's Got Shall Get, Them That's Not Shall Lose." Yeah, I won the national contest, and they had 8 other affiliates from their station, CBS, participating in the contest. And like I said, I won out of all of them. We ended up in New York at Richard Burton's. At that time, it was a disco at Richard Burton's nightclub when he and Liz were together. And then I won that national contest. And they took us to the White House, and I got a bracelet or some sort from the White House. And there I am with Hubert Humphrey putting an award on my wrist. And then they moved me to New York with this fellowship. And I started taking a lot of, signed me up with a lot of classes for acting and singing and writing and dancing. And that is when I signed with CBS and met Clive Davis, and they signed me along with, what's the group? Oh, Simon and Garfunkel. Yeah, we were all in there together around that time.
And that was about 1968. And you signed.
68.
Yeah, you signed with Columbia Records. Was Clive Davis involved with that at the time?
He was not president then. He was in charge of A&R, I do believe.
Right. Okay. Because one of your first records that come out of there, we'll play a snippet of it now, which I just say your vocals are absolutely amazing on this. This is one of them records that should be played forever. It's just incredible.
Are you kidding me? I'd like to hear. I don't even have that record. You know how long ago that's been? At least, I would say 60 years ago, maybe, yes, a little over.
68, it was recorded. It was released.
And that was my...
Yeah.
That was my first time going into a studio at CBS. And I'll tell you, one of the times coming out of the studio, I'm standing and waiting for a bus. And right outside the door at CBS Records, I think that's 54th Street between Broadway and 7th Avenue, there is Miles Davis standing waiting for a taxi. And I come out the door and I'm waiting. A bus or some sort. I can't be. I was waiting, and there was Clive Davis, and he turned around and gave me a look that made me freeze in my tracks. I mean, because I recognized who he was. He didn't know who I was, but we were both CBS artists at the time, and that was quite an amazing experience because he just stared at me and he kept looking me up and down. So I guess he was sizing me up maybe to be in his camp. One of his women, I don't know, but I was too young to really understand what was going on, but I knew I wasn't going with that man. That I didn't know. I was not getting in a taxi with him, that's for sure.
You're listening to Soul Discovery, and I've got an amazing lady with me, Eloise Laws. Eloise, that is one of the greatest records of all time. Incredible. Big production on that. How did that happen?
Well, CBS was searching for the right song. And what really amazes me, they had just let Aretha Franklin go because they didn't know what to do with her recording wise. And so they said, okay, well, let's try this young lady and see what happens. And they put me with, I forget his name, Something Gold was the producer. And this record did chart. I know it took maybe a day or two. I learned the song, and the next thing I knew, I was in the studio. And then the next thing I knew, it was on the charts. And then, of course, I started doing a lot of television as a result of that particular song and traveling with a lot of very well-known comedians. At that time, artists, singers used to open for comedians. That was the general format back in the 60s and the 70s. So I started working with people like, again, like Flip Wilson and George Carlin. And these were very, very well-known comedians. Alan King. And then eventually I met up with Harry Belafonte, heard me and saw me on television and came to see my show a couple of times. And so also did Bill Cosby.
Wow.
And we know the story about that. But I actually, for someone with talent, and so I did not receive any abuse on that from his group, the Bill Cosby group, and his agent and all. We had actually, it was a mutual respect, to be quite honest with you. So there was no harm, no foul there.
And then you joined Fifth Dimension. Tell us how did that occur and why?
Well, now that's a long story. After many years now, I had been in New York and working through CBS, doing nightclubs, Playboy Club. One of the first big clubs I came to was the Playboy Club in London. And my mom was my chaperone. My mom, through another gentleman that I met there who would just come to the club to hear me all the time, he was a record producer. He took her in the studio with the Beatles, and she actually sat and played keyboards for the Beatles. And they were obviously brand new on the scene. But a lot of people don't know this, but my mom met the Beatles and she was in the studio with the Beatles and she played for the Beatles, played keyboards. I wish they had had a cell phone then. And I wish we had a record of that, but I don't think that will ever happen. But this I do know, she met the Beatles and she went into the studio with him and she played keyboards. He would come and pick her up every day. And one of the things that he did was to take her into the studio where the Beatles were recording. I don't know if the recording was ever released, but she actually played keyboards for them, not on a recording per se, but she was with the Beatles in the studio and she did play piano.
So that led on to joining the group.
That led on to me working a lot of clubs around the U.S. Eventually, I departed from CBS and went with Invictus, a music merchant. Things didn't go so well in terms of touring. So I decided to go with this agency while I was out working one of the Playboy clubs. Mark Gordon from the Fifth Dimension were looking to replace Billy and Marilyn. Not replace them, but they wanted to leave the group and go on their own. And someone told him to go to this club. There's this singer there. And they did. And after I performed, the manager of the club said, there's a gentleman here from the Fifth Dimension. He'd like to talk with you. The rest is history. He said, hey, would you like to join the group? You have been our first pick. We've auditioned about 1,000 girls in New York and your name came up. And so that's why we flew out here to see you and to hear you. And we'd like for you to take Marilyn's place. And I was just thrilled and elated because they had several hits, big hits. And at the time they were working in New York, working in Las Vegas, making a ton of money. And that to me at that time, because now I'm on my own. I don't have any representation, no manager, no nothing. So I'm running scared a little bit because I've got to pay rent and take care of myself. And I had let my previous organization who had helped me, I sort of let them go because it, for a lot of reasons, I wasn't getting financial statements, and I wasn't doing a lot of things. And it was recommended by my brother Hubert that, you know, you need to start taking care of your own affairs. Why don't you just go on your own for a while? It was a mistake. I never should have left CBS. Never, ever. But I did. And this is a part of this my showbiz journey. And most artists go, this is nothing new. I'm not unique in that, the word I'm looking for. You become a little discouraged. You're not getting some of the things you're asking for. And you become skeptical about whether or not you're being business-wise, you're being taken care of properly. So I decided to do things on my own. And then the fifth dimension fell into my space. And I said, okay, this is good. And again, they were making great money in Vegas. And I was looking for something like that. And it was easy because you're part of a group now. You don't have to make a lot of decisions as to choosing, getting musicians to, you know, in your band and doing all the work on securing the job, securing musicians, and setting up your own rehearsals, basically doing all the work as well as performing. So when that opportunity came along, I said, you know what? This is what I need now. And that's how that happened.
Discovery, Eloise Laws on vocals. Tighten Him Up. 1972, Merchant Music from that wonderful label Invictus with Holland Dozier Holland. Eloise Laws on the phone. Eloise, how did that happen? How did all that come together with them guys?
You're taking me back, and I love it because it was hearing that song just has so many wonderful memories. It was my first introduction to the Invictus merchant group, the group Holland Dozier Holland. They actually, I was living in New York, of course, and they saw one of the TV programs I did. And they had a few hits, I do believe, with Frida Payne. And they were looking for someone to replace her because she was having the same problems I had with CBS, you know, not getting the usual things that happens to artists when they don't, you know, you don't get any music reports, you don't get any money, and you're out there, but your finances are not that great. And Holland Dozier, they flew to New York, took me to lunch, and we sat and talked, and they said, you know, we would like for you to sign with the company. So they were looking for someone to replace Frida. Well, you know, you don't replace Frida Payne, but when she heard the news that I was joining the label, the word came back to me, and it was through Edward Holland. He said that, I want you to know Frida sent you a message. She said, two hoes can't work the same block. So she was happy to move on.
Wow. Okay. Right.
And I thought that was a compliment, actually.
Yes, very much so. But you went on, and then your next record, which is Love Factory, went on and became a massive record in the scene in the UK, in the Northern Soul scene, yes, at the time. And it still, yes, gets hammered on the dance floor today. Let's let the listeners that don't know this, if they don't know it, they shouldn't be listening to the show. But let's have a listen to this, because this is just completely takes you into another zone. When you're on the floor to this, you're completely transfixed on just the lyrics, and the vocals take you to another place.
Okay. It has a wonderful feel.
Love Factory. Many pairs of shoes I've worn out on the dance floor to that record, and I'm not joking. In 1974, I went to my first all-nighter, and I just can't believe that record. And now I'm talking to you. Incredible. It was written and produced by Holland Dozier Holland, but you had Popcorn Wiley on there as well. Did you work with Popcorn a lot?
Of course, I worked with all those guys out in Detroit. I would actually fly out to Detroit. You know, back in those days, you'd have to actually go into the studio with live musicians, which was really wonderful. And how we did recordings back in the day, which really gives you that full impact of music, because you've got rhythm, melody, harmony, beautiful lyrics, And that was a classically done by Holland Goja Holland. The harmony, the Jones Girls, I believe, were backup singers on that track. They were also artists on the music Invictus Music Merchant label as well.
Yeah. Popcorn Wiley, how much work did you do? Record anything else with him?
I do believe we did another song. There was another album that I did called Don't Camouflage Feeling. I think on that particular album, I did a couple of his songs.
You never actually got to work with him as a writer?
No, did not. No, unfortunately, no.
Okay.
No, unfortunately.
And on the other side of that, which became a single later on, was Stay With Me. That is just, I'm going to play it. I'm sorry. I've just got to play it and then we can talk about it.
Okay.
Discovery, my special guest Eloise Laws, and I apologize for cutting the record short, but we've got so much to squeeze in and I want to get all the information I can out of Eloise, because this is just an incredible journey. Stay With Me, that came out in 1973 on Merchant Music, and then it was released on 1975 on Victus Records. Eddie Holland, Brian Holland wrote and produced that song on Eloise Laws. Eloise, incredible.
Thank you, Mick. It was fun. I always knew whenever Edward Holland would call and said, "Hey, we have a song for you. We're going to send it to you. Give it a listen. See if we'd like to record it on you." And I just loved, most of the things that they wrote. And then Popcorn, and then there was what's his name? God, I can't think of the other guy who used to write for them always. They were all good. They were all great writers. Norman Whitfield and Ron Miller and all those guys out of Motown were all good, great writers.
Invictus kind of went disco. They had the first 12-inch record come out of their label with this record, Love Goes Deeper Than That, 12-inch, right. 1977. Was that deliberately to jump on the disco scene? Was that
I think so. They were trying to keep up, or, they were very innovative. They tried to always be ahead of the scene. It was about to happen, and they jumped right on it. They were always either ahead of the game or right at the very big, right in there. Musically, they kind of knew, had a good sense always of where the industry was headed. Don't say you love me, 'cause it's a nice thing to say.
Disco. I'm sorry. Did that affect you as a singer?
Yes, it did indeed. I was just reminding myself of when some of these songs recorded, Edward Holland and Brian, they would stand in the studio, and if they liked it, they would really start gyrating their body and moving around. And I was just implementing and showing this to Tammy, how they would move when they would, you know, when they would hear their music and when I would sing it. And they would be in the visual part of the studio, out in the big part of the studio, moving around. And you knew that if they moved, they started moving, they liked it, you know. So that was always a good sign.
Did you work with the rest of the artists that were on them labels, like Glass House, Chairman of the Board, the Brino Brothers, Eighth Day, so on, Laura Lee?
No, I did not. They kept me sort of isolated. McKinley, I think McKinley was their arranger or did a lot of the writing. I worked with him a lot. But, you know, later years when I left Invictus and Music Merchant, I worked with Ron Miller. You see, nobody really got that. He was with Motown, and he wrote the Stevie Wonder, Yes to You, Yes to Me. He wrote For Once in My Life. He wrote a musical called Suds, and I played the role of Suds, and I worked with him for about 2 years. Pasadena Civic Auditorium, we ran for about 3 weeks, got great reviews, and we were hoping to go to Broadway with it, but then Ron Miller took sick. He had lung cancer, and eventually he died. But he wrote some amazing songs, as you know. But Stevie Wonder and For Once in My Life is a classic. And to be able to work with him, he at that time he had left Motown, and he was going in another direction. He was trying to write stage productions, and so he chose me to do the lead in a production called Suds. Had the most beautiful music. Diverted a bit because I was thinking of all the great writers that started with Motown, and he was one of them, Ron Miller.
Wow, he was, yeah, incredible writer. And that was your album in 77, Ain't It a Good Feeling, which was produced by Gene Page.
Yes, now that produced by Gene Page was with Linda Creed.
Yes, I was coming to that. That was the next album. That was Linda Creed and Wawa Watson, Wilton Felder, Ray Parker Jr., your brother, Ronnie Laws, on that album.
Yeah, that was a big record, Mick. It really was here in the States, because Far Out Production, they had signed me on, And they put me on ABC Records, and that was my first album with them that really got the recognition that I deserved, I think, because Linda Creed and I went on a promotional tour with that album. We went to all the major markets in the U.S., and that's when You're Incredible and Love Comes Easy sort of pushed me record-wise where I should have gone all along with a lot of the previous stuff that I'd done. But that particular one really pushed me to the forefront of the record industry because it had such great songs on it. His House and Me, Love Comes Easy, as I said, and Linda Creed wrote most of the songs on that album. You know, she had previously worked with the Stylistics, the OJs, maybe.
A Minute. Eloise, the album, ABC Records, 1977. Eloise, that was produced by Linda Creed, and there were some wonderful people on there. Like I said, there was Wilton Felder, your brother Ronnie Laws, Ray Parker Jr. These guys were all coming to put their mark on the scene at the time, and they were working with you. It was fantastic.
This was the best of the best. You couldn't get any better than that. And Linda Creed, she was the type of artist and songwriter that only wanted to work with the best. And when I met her, she again was so thrilled and delighted, as was I, to work with Linda Creed. But she was just thrilled. She said, this was something I've always wanted to do all my life. We were like magic. It was so easy in the studio. It's just some of the takes, you know, some people sometimes, not all artists, but it takes 2, 3, or 4 takes in the studio, or you do it in bits and pieces. But with her songs, the melody and the lyrics, the message was so beautiful. You didn't want to chop it up. I would just do the entire song and they would take whatever from each time. But it was really easy. I would do 3 or 4 takes and she would say, that's enough. You can't do it. She said, it's not going to get any better than that. And that's always refreshing when you hear that from the writer telling the artist that, you know what, I'm happy. It's not going to get any better than that. Thank you. Thank you. That's to me is the ultimate compliment. And she did that when we were in the studio. She wouldn't take 4, 5, 6 takes or stop you and said, okay, can you do that again? She would just take it, you know, what she got. And it's always good. Now it's a whole different process with, you know, they don't even I don't know, it's drum machines and no musicians. And therefore, there's no real feeling in the music because it's all it's like painting by the numbers.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later in the show because I want to ask you a certain question, see what your feelings
okay.
on. But moving to 1980, Linda Creed moved with you at the time, and you were produced by Linda Creed and your brother, Ronnie Laws. But the arrangements was the wonderful, incredible Tom Bell. And you were working with Barbara Ingman, Phil Hurt from Fantasy Records, and so on. But what a wonderful album that was, 1980, Eloise Laws. How did that happen? Why did that happen at that specific time?
Well, after the first Linda Creed, she was very anxious to go right back in, and she wanted to continue to work with Tom Bell, number one. And I was actually surprised that she and Tom were... Actually, it was an opportunity for her to do another project with Tom before she lost him. And when I say lost him, he didn't pass right away, but he had moved to Seattle, Washington. He decided to become a recluse. She was quite in love with Tom, and not just working with him, but on many levels. And this was an opportunity once again to work with him. And we actually flew up to Seattle, and we spent 2 weeks at his house. And we did that last album with Tom as the arranger and Linda as the songwriter and producer. One of the things she really wanted to do this album, and that's why we ended up going to Seattle and actually doing, we stayed in a hotel. We stayed with him while we were putting it together. And I actually have a song on that album. I believe I wrote one song on the album. But she wanted to spend that time with Tom. And she was not, you know, we lost her to breast cancer. She wasn't. So this was something she had her mind set on doing. And that was, you know, was working with Tom again and doing this second album. She didn't want to just do one. She definitely had in mind to do two or three albums, really. Fortunately, we were able to do a second one.
Go away, my sweet.
beauty, Eloise Laws, taken from the album Eloise Laws, Liberty Records, out of Hollywood, California. Produced and arranged by the fantastic Tom Bell, Got You Into My Life. Eloise, wonderful, incredible. Big production on that. Did they spend a lot of money on arrangements and everything? And, you know, because it was starting to peter out because record labels weren't going to invest as much as they did during that period of the say it stopped around 82, 83. Well, did you notice a difference or were you okay on that at the time in 1980?
It's a great question, Nick. And first of all, your timing on that issue is right on point because they used to put a lot of money into productions. And this last album, the one that you just played and the one prior. Now, with the Holland Doja Holland, he used a lot of his friends and he owned the company. So I'm not sure about how much money they put into it. But ABC, CBS, those companies used to put a lot of money into productions up until they no longer used musicians. They used the drum machines and started, you know, setting up their own recordings in their home and stuff like that. But these productions, some of these productions, especially the Linda Creed ones, were somewhere in the $200,000 range because they actually bring musicians in, backup singers, studio costs, the producer, the engineer. So it would run somewhere between $150,000 to $200,000, which is unheard of today, unless you are an Adele or I don't know, you know, because a lot of people like a Stevie Wonder, they go in and do their own production. They have their own studio. My brother Hubert has his own studio, a 24-track studio in the South. So artists were able to cut back a lot. And consequently, the record companies did the same because they would call themselves self-sufficient. They would be able to go in and do their own productions. And a lot of artists did that. But yeah, the productions used to be when I was coming up with different labels, they would get money from the record company, which Linda Creed did and Tom Bell, and it was somewhere between $150,000 maybe to $200,000.
A lot of money, a lot of money.
Yeah.
A lot of. In the meantime, your brother Ronnie produces and arranges an album in the same year in 1980, and he features you on it with your lovely sister, and just an incredible, because it was a massive hit in the UK and Europe, every generation on United Artists.
Oh yeah,
people were after this at the time. It was played on the radio out of London. It was we never had many radio stations that were playing American black music at the time then. But you had to listen to these little pirate stations that were playing it. And this was played. And when I heard it on a Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, I ran out. I went to London, got a train into London, and I found the album. It took me 6 or 7 hours to find it, but I got an album. And that's how it was in them days. But how did this come about? Because Ronnie was always a jazz musician, still is. But this crossed over to every boundary of music. Genre was totally different on this. Just an incredible song.
Mm-hmm. I have to agree with you. Every generation was really, really quite beautiful. He had me and Deborah doing the melody, the singing. And I think we did most of the backup as well. But I think I did the lead on. Oh, no, Ronnie did the lead on Every Generation.
Say, 'cause 'Cause every generation of us reflects a movie scene often more than twice. Child is born to live, but then the master plan. Boy grows up, leaves his home to be a man.
Years of wine for the wise. Every generation of our
couldn't play Ronnie Laws without playing Hubert Laws and our special guest on the phone.
we're listening and I'm thinking, that sounds like Hubert.
Yes, it was. Yes. It was, as far as I'm aware, as I don't know, but I might be wrong. 1973, the album was called Morning Star on CTI Records, and that track was called
Morning Star.
Yeah, and the album and the track we played was No More. Now, apparently that was you on the vocals with Deborah. That was the first time you recorded with your brother. Correct me if I'm
wrong. That's right. No, that's, well, I think you're right. I believe you're right. Because we were, he was still on the East Coast. And we were on the West Coast then, I believe. But yeah, that was one of the first, on CTI where we actually were featured, Deborah and I, yes.
Yeah, and before that was the fantastic Ronnie Laws, Every Generation United Artists Records, 1980. Now, what was it like? You got to be kind here. What was it like with a family growing up with so much talent in it?
Well, it was somewhat competitive.
That was a big sigh.
Because it was somewhat competitive. We always used Hubert because he was one of the first out of the box to leave home and to pursue a musical career. As you know, he was with the Jazz Crusaders. And then he eventually ventured off and got a scholarship from Juilliard School of Music. Let the truth be told, he thinks that that was probably a mistake taking that scholarship because he said they never let him play jazz, but he did learn to read music and he also started to get commercial work with commercials and also started playing with a lot of big orchestras, symphony orchestras, because he learned to read and he met Quincy Jones, of course, and he was such a well-rounded musician that he was always used on everything. If you listen to some early Aretha Franklin, you're going to hear him with all the solos, some of her big Daydreaming, I'm Thinking of You. And let me see one of the other ones that Aretha. The moment I wake up, I'm on my makeup. Hubert is the flute. Say a Little Prayer for You. He's on that album. He's on every. And they obviously said to him, look, man, just there's no sheet music. Just go for it. Go for what you know. And he's amazing on those. I was listening to some of Aretha's stuff a few weeks ago, and I was like, my God, Hubert is all in the mix on that. But back to your original question. At home, we were competitive, but in a very positive way. Our parents were very supportive, and they knew that we loved music because a lot of it was in our DNA. Both parents were musically inclined. And so we got a lot of support, and we all had our careers at different times. Hubert was first, I was second, Ronnie was third, and we all brought Deborah in. We were all responsible for her career. Unlike Ronnie and Hubert and I, we all got scholarships, or we were all, you know, fingered out by various record companies. Deborah, on the other hand, Hubert actually produced her first album in his studio. And we grabbed her out of Houston and told her to give up her day job and to come out west. And she was produced by Ronnie and Hubert on that very special, the album which she sings very special, which was one of her big, big hits. But the rest of us, we did it the hard way. We, you know, worked clubs, and producers would come in and see us and want to sign us. And at least that's how it happened for me and for Ronnie. So
did you get to work with the Crusaders?
Yes, I did. I worked with Crusaders. I did a couple of festivals with them because Randy Crawford, you know, did Street Life, the Joe Sample thing, the Street Life.
Yeah. And I've got a wonderful story about Randy Crawford. When that album came out, I bought it on import, and they flew the Crusaders over. There was Styx Hooper. Mm-hmm. I forgot their names now. Mm-hmm. They're terrible. But anyway, they flew them up. Wiltonfeld, Styx Hooper. Yeah,
Styx Hooper. And Wayne Henderson.
Wayne Henderson, yes. Who'd left the band. He'd left the band by then. He'd gone.
They, for whatever reason, they parted company. They didn't agree on some of the same things financially. Mm. So they went their separate ways. That's another story as well.
Joe Sample. Sorry.
truly, yes. But I worked with them a couple of times. I had to do Street Life. and which was not my cup of tea. It was Randy Crawford's song. I mean, she got a big hit with that. But later years, she wasn't feeling well, and so they asked me to come in, and so I was fortunate enough to work with them, because they were one of the really top jazz groups, or always forever, actually. I mean, they were truly an amazing group.
Yeah, I caught them, like I was saying, I caught them live when the album came out, and they brought them over. They flew them over because the demand for the album. And it was the first time Randy Crawford had ever come on stage. And she walked on the stage and she started to sing, and she stopped and she started to cry. And she apologized, says, "I've never realized that I was like this much." And she composed herself and she destroyed the place. It was incredible, incredible moment.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. She was amazing.
So question I'm going to ask you as well. I'm going to interview Ronnie in the future, but I've got to ask you this question. When he was with Earth, Wind & Fire, because he was on the first album that they recorded, he left them. Was there a reason behind why he left them, that as they were just about to make it big in the whole scene in the world?
You know, I was living in New York at the time, and we weren't close musically, geographically at all. And so I wasn't following Ronnie as much as I was following Hubert, because he was with Mongo Santa Maria. And I caught him just very briefly once with Mongo Santa Maria right after he left the Crusaders. But Ronnie, as far as Earth, Wind & Fire, I'm told, Maurice eventually just told him that, you know, he was good enough to just go on his own. Although, you know, they loved him being with them, but eventually they said, "Hey, man, you know, you can stand up on your own." And that's what happened. I mean, they left on favorable terms, because he still works to this day. He works with Larry Dunn if Larry's not working on his project, he's working on Larry's project. They work together quite a bit. As a matter of fact, they just did a cover of Ribbon in the Sky. And I don't know if you've heard it yet, but you can find it on YouTube. It's only been out maybe 6 weeks. Stevie Wonder. Have you heard it yet?
Yeah, Howard Hewitt on lead vocals as well.
Howard Hewitt, yeah. Deborah. Yes, exactly. Now, I could have done a better job on Ribbon in the Sky.
that's my next question. My next question is, this is a point blank question. When are the family going to record just a whole album on their own?
That's a very loaded question, and I wish I had the answer. And hopefully, because we are getting on in age, Hubert being the eldest, you know what? Thank you for putting fire in my belly, because maybe I can be the one to bring this to the forefront and try and get everybody to do this. You'd be surprised. Unlike the Jackson family, they're not the only one that, you know, will always want to go their separate ways. It's been a while since we've done things together. Hubert and I will work together pretty much without any conflicts. Ronnie and Deborah sometimes will work together without conflict. Bringing the four of us together, I'll tell you why it's hard. Musically, Ronnie feels like his music is more hardcore. Hubert feels like his music is very, you know, mellow and soft, because his instrument is a very delicate, soft instrument. And Deborah and I, we are pretty much on the same page. We love to sing. She's a bit more R&B than me. She's not really a jazz. So our taste in music varies in terms of our influences. I mean,
but you record live, you do festivals, etc., with Hubert, and you cover some of your songs and some of the Ronnie Laws's songs. You do nail it, and I just think bringing the whole family together, if you just you do your songs, get them to play the instruments on the back, and then you do the same to them, vice versa, and there'll be no conflict. I'm just trying it, because I think
easier said than done, Mick. But guess what? You've given me a goal to work towards, and I'll do my best. You know, if anybody can do it, it'll be me, because I am able to get them together in the same room. And sometimes what I'll do is if I have a gig, and sometimes I'll ask Ronnie, and I won't tell him that Hubert is coming, and we can all, we're all on the stage together. And this happened about maybe 6 or 7 years ago, a Christmas show at a new club, jazz club in downtown Los Angeles in the Art District. And I asked them all to come and participate with me, and we did. And it was quiet. It was one for the ages, because people loved it to see us all on stage together working. That's something that, thank you for the suggestion. I'll start working on it. It's going to take all of that and then some. It's going to take an act of Congress. Okay.
I'll send you some ideas. That's all I'm going to say.
Please. Welcome that. Welcome it. Okay.
Right. Back to yourself. You released an album out of the blue completely. You had an album in 82, 81 and 1999. But the album that came in 2003, I melted. I went to pieces when I heard this. And ever since that moment, I've been trying to get in touch with you. This is one of the greatest records that's ever been recorded. I'm just going to play it and then everybody will realise what we're talking about.
Okay.
Tenderness, having you here with me, real tenderness, like it's supposed to be. So long I've waited, remembering your kiss, and now to be like this. This is tenderness, feeling your fingertips, hearing my name whispered from your lips.
Ever looking for a record in life and You don't know what to look for. Just go and buy that album. The album's called Secrets, and it features Ronnie Laws on there, Deborah Laws, and of course the main vocalist, Eloise Laws. The record is perfection. You can't get no better than that. And in 2003, on the Soul Discovery, we made that our number one record of the year. It's just an incredible piece of music.
It was a sleeper, Mitch. You're right. And thank you for promoting it. It was a sleeper, truly.
How did that come together? Because it's just one of them records. I just think if you put that in a film score, it'd just sell the film easy, because everybody would remember that moment.
I agree. You know, there's a film, a song that I did with Holland O.J. Holland, Ain't It Good Feeling Good. It's in a film. It's a black film. It's called 1001. And it's about a mother who loses her child to foster care. And she finds him and picks him up. But let's go back to Secrets. This record never got the recognition it deserves. And it's like brand new today. The music, it sounds new. It's fresh. And so we'll figure it out. But it's one of my best works, I think.
It's you've done some good work, but I just melted when I first heard it. I just couldn't control how you feel about a certain record. I just could not stop playing it. It was just one of them records, and everybody thought I was mad at the time, saying, "Are you still listening to that record?" And I'm going, "Yes, you don't understand." Is the CD available? Because I know this instrumental with Ronnie's available, but the CD, the vocal version of Tenderness, mm-hmm. is that available to everyone?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, okay, because it's very hard to track. A lot of people are finding it hard to track down.
Well, they should not be getting a vocal of Ronnie, because he's only on that one little section.
No, I don't mean the version's out, but it's an instrumental with just Ronnie playing on it, not your vocals. Your vocals have been taken off it.
What? Who? And Ronnie? Are you sure that's Ronnie? Because Ronnie wouldn't do that without
No. It's not Ronnie. It's your album. It's on Spotify, it's just the instrumental version.
I wonder who did that without getting permission. But anyway, we'll look into that. Okay. We'll look into that. That's too bad.
Right.
Because I don't think the song really makes it unless it has the lyrics to it. I mean, I get it being an instrumental, but
no,
I also get it better. I also get it better with the lyrics. So I don't know.
So do I. I get it a lot better.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you a question, and I need your opinion on this. We're having a lot of problems now with new music where it's all AI. It's not artists at all. Are you having that experience in America?
Yeah, we're starting. Yeah, unfortunately, there is no way they have found a way to control AI. And it's going to be a huge interruption, but I think people will find their way around it, because a lot of people are starting to know the difference. They're going, oh, that's AI. Oh, that's AI. I've written a song called Wake Up America, and I was working with a guy by the name of Greg Jackson, who used to work for Holland O.J. Holland. He lives out here, and he came to my house, and he set it all up on the computer, and I gave him the lyrics and the melody, which I wrote both. And he took it, and the next thing I know, he did an AI version of it with his vocals on it, and I've had to stop him. Yeah, it potentially has and will become a bigger problem, but I think that people are going to be able to discern what's AI, because it's going to be so much of it that they're going to see the difference. You see what I'm saying? I really do believe that it will fail at some point. It will start to fail, and people are going to know the difference.
Yeah, at the moment if I'm playing new music, I have to go back to the actual artists and find out who they are, etc. Find out the pedigree. If I don't know that now, I don't play the artist, because I don't know if it's AI or not, because there's so many flying
out. I know.
Anyway, what's your plans for the future?
My plans for the future are pretty much the same. I will continue to do music. I will do a couple of festivals here and there. I'm also working on a show called ED Blues. as a producer, but I'm also there insisting that I play a small part in it, and which will be my hopes are that it will go to Broadway, and which is really, really my first love. I mean, I've always wanted to do my whole point when I first got in the business. That was my goal, was to go to Broadway. It took me 30 years to get there, but I did. I got there. And now that I've had a taste of it, I really love theater, but I love theater with good music. I love musical theater. I don't just like the drama part of it, but I like musical theater. And I'm working on that project, which I really think you can be looking out for it. But I'd like for the family, as you suggested, I'd like for us to get together once again, because we're all getting older, once again, to come together and do something, a concert together. It would really bring not only us together, but bring a lot of people who love our music together as well. And I think we must do this. I just think that it's something that we must do while we can.
Yes, I agree with you. While you're on, what about these documentaries that you're involved in? Can you enlighten us on that?
Documentaries? Yeah. I'm doing some documentaries. I didn't know that I did that. Oh, my book?
Yeah, your book as well. But I heard on the grapevine you were involved in some documentaries.
Oh, well, there's a book called Through My Mother's Eyes. Mm. It was not my idea, but I helped to facilitate it by getting a lot of the artists to participate, such as Freda Payne and Mary Wilson of the Supremes, Bill Duke, Malcolm Jamar Warner, myself, my brother Hubert, and a lot of political people here. It's a book, and I'm trying. The documentary has been done. I need to get it, someone to buy it, like Netflix or one of the.
Got you.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But the documentary has been done. It's been done, and it's quite beautiful.
Okay. Well, I look forward to you. I will keep in touch. I will be chasing you about this new album with your family. annoying you, but
wonderful.
Eloise Laws, the lady of With a Voice from Heaven, thank you very much for being part of the show. Is there anything you'd like to say to the listeners?
No, Mick, except that I'm this was such a pleasure, and you have awakened my musical mental being by playing some early works of mine that I had forgotten about. And I have to say, I don't know if I've gotten better or I just keep pushing ahead. The early stuff is good, but the later stuff is even better, I think, more seasoned. But I've always been fortunate enough to work with great artists, great writers, and great producers, and that is such a blessing. So I appreciate that. Thank you I thoroughly enjoyed this. You've awakened some very musical darkness that's been in my spirit for a long time, and now quite aware of some of the things that I've done in the past.
Eloise Laws, thank you very much.
Thank you once again.
Thank you. thoroughly enjoyed, you know, the memories and listening to the music. And as and you, with the questions, you were certainly thoroughly prepared, and you asked some very important questions.
Okay.
That people needed to know. Yeah, people need to know, and I thank you for that.
Goodbye.